This is a Collider.com audio interview.
How long has this idea sort of been percolating in your head after District 9? Was this something that you've been wanting to do for a while?
Yeah, it's like, you know, these organic things that just sort of, you never really know when they begin or end to a certain degree. I got arrested in Tijuana, like...
Who hasn't?
Yeah. But no, it wasn't really fair because I hadn't done anything. I got shaken down would be a better description, I think. And I ended up walking along the, weirdly, like quite close to the U.S. border. And at night with like Black Hawks flying up and down because of the naval base. And that was when I was 25. So that was before District 9. And I always thought that image and that concept, you know, that an hour before I was on the other side of the fence, it stuck with me so much that I thought someday that would turn into something. And essentially Elysium really is that, you know. It's that event.
What's it like going from struggling to, you know, make a movie to all of a sudden being able to, like, have the budget to basically do a shot or to set up the camera or to do what you want with, like, basically some freedom?
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting is I actually feel I'm at that point now after Elysium. I never actually felt that on Elysium. So I feel like it's been such a fight to get to where I am at now that for the first time, I feel like going forward now, I can actually now try to become a better filmmaker. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's like everything that I've done so far, it's like you're just trying to keep your head above water, you know? And there's political stuff happening and there's so many things happening, but, you know, you're learning which crew members you want to work with, which ones stab you in the back, you know, who changes, which positions work, which ones don't work. Now, for the first time, I feel like it's a flat plateau now. And it's like, if I want to, I can actually become a better filmmaker. Now I can actually get the noise away, like out of my head from other people, and hone the craft of filmmaking. You know, so hopefully 10 years or 20 years from now, if I don't die from Legionnaire's disease, which I thought I had on Monday, I will be a better filmmaker.
But to the point, I mean, District 9 starred your buddy Charlton.
Yeah.
And then going... After the success of District 9, Oscar nominated, you were able to get Matt Damon, Jodie Foster.
No,
it must have changed something for you.
Yeah, no, it did. It definitely did. I mean, I wrote to the I love the financier of this film, Modi Wichick from MRC, and I wrote to him when we were shooting the film, like halfway through it, and I basically was saying thank you for allowing me to be an artist that can stand in a garbage dump in Mexico City, shooting exactly what I want to shoot. You know, so yes. You're right. But the difference is, even though you have the political ability to shoot what you want, and the film is what I want, you're still outside the realm of the film. You're still figuring out the sort of, there's the static noise of like politics, and you're learning as you go, you know? Like, here's another way of thinking of it. Ridley Scott, on his like 780th film now, just like arrives at set. It's like a machine. It's like a well-oiled machine with crew members that just know him and know what he wants, and everything just goes and he leaves. You know what I mean? It's like, I want to get closer to where it's pure, just pure artwork, and there isn't any other extraneous force in there that's kind of making you not focus 100%.
How do you feel about working with the lesser-known actors versus working with like Matt Damon and Jodie Foster? How do you feel that affects that sort of that journey towards becoming that well-oiled machine?
The actors fit into that very smoothly, actually. You know, it's more setting up the way that the structure of the film happens. The actors are the good part. I do feel like I was very lucky on Elysium. A big part of it was kind of meeting the actors and making sure that I felt like they were people that are like me, that like I don't really want to just go to parties and hang out on red carpets and stuff. It's like it's about the film, and they all felt that way when I met them. So I feel like I kind of lucked out because it was a group of people that wanted to do the same thing, that were just professionals, and we just made the film, you know. And I think if you can continue to do that as a filmmaker, then you're in a good place. But you know, every once in a while, you can have someone who just kind of fucks the entire process up. And,
right.
Yeah.
There was stories, you know, that Eminem had originally been considered for this. I mean, I would never think of Matt Damon in the same light as him.
Yeah.
How do you think they both seem to fit? Like, how did you make that transition?
Well, it the fact that that came out was slightly erroneous, only in the sense that the version of Elysium that I wanted Eminem for was not this film. It was a very different version. And when I came up with the idea after District 9, like, I was very much in this mindset, the sociological kind of mindset of just all of this kind of Tijuana border fence kind of thing, and growing up in South Africa, I was just interested in it, and I knew that I wanted to make a science fiction film about the haves and the have-nots. And the original script that I had was purposefully much lower budget, and the setup was completely different. There was no space habitat. The way that the rich lived was this, actually, like, a very cool idea that I want to one day turn into something else. So, because I like it so much, but it was totally different to this film. So in that low budget, edgier, stranger film, in that context, I wanted like an unusual star, and that's when he was approached. But then, what happened was the concept that I'm talking about that I liked never felt right for the story. It wasn't really designed for a haves, have nots kind of story, so it kept not feeling right. So I shelved that. And then I came up with the idea of a physical ring that you could go to and that is lined with, like, Beverly Hills mansions. And the second that happened, I just jacked the budget up by $60 million. Mm-hmm. And that changed the whole way I thought of it, you know. And then I was still apprehensive to use stars, but I thought if it costs more to get the ring made, you know, it's going to cost more anyway, why not try to make it more of, like, a cinematic experience rather than some under the radar kind of film. Mm-hmm. And so my whole thinking kind of changed. And then I went through a list of people, and Matt really was the only guy on the list because a lot of other people come with, I'm just fearful of them messing with the script or, you know, doing something. And Damon has such a good reputation that way. So that's the story.
You wouldn't cast Edward Norton then?
No. Well, I'm pretty sure that, yeah.
Well, in addition to being actors, I mean, Matt and Joe, you're both filmmakers in their own right. Did that make a difference as far as them understanding your vision and maybe not wanting to mess with it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's not even so much like understanding the vision. It's even beyond that. It's just the way that you work on set. If someone understands that they're a cog of a very big machine, and they are filmmakers. I mean, Matt hasn't directed something yet, but he keeps almost directing something,
right.
And he knows exactly what it takes, and he's interested in it, right? So when that is your understanding, the way he described it to me was, you're helping the director create this magic trick where you're basically fooling the audience for 2 hours into believing X. And having an asset in someone who's trying to help you create that illusion means they'll do whatever they need to help you create the illusion. Another way of looking at it is, where's my close-up? You know, my makeup doesn't look good. You know, and it's like, that's a problem. That's something else. So it goes slightly beyond just, they can still be worried about their makeup and want to help your vision. Do you see what I mean? But if they understand that they really understand filmmaking, they know that it's about getting the shot before the sun goes down and you don't have time to, you know, get your hair done.
Here's my challenge, though, and I'm interested that you're talking about a stranger or another version of Elysium. I love District 9, and I came to this with that sort of interest in something sort of raw and edgy. And I have to be honest, so much of the stuff I felt like I could predict from start to finish, and it was beautiful to watch, and I love the social, you know, the social justice parts of it. But I'm interested in you, like, if you've now arrived to the Elysium of the Hollywood film scene, why not take that $100 million and do something really edgy and interesting? Because you've got the chops and the credibility to do it.
It depends on the kind of film you want to make. You know, Elysium really is the film that I wanted to make. Like, it's. I think. You know, again, if I don't die of Legionnaire's disease, looking back on it, like five films down the line, it will continue to be. It'd probably be the most. It may be the most expensive film, and it will probably be. It'll be something I will eternally be proud of. So it was the film that I wanted to make, but. But as you know, sort of answering your question, the next film I want to make is far lower budget than this, and is fucking mental. Mm-hmm. And the film after that is, I think it may end my career. It's like it's a comedy that may, I don't know what will happen. And I like that I don't know what will happen. You know, if it's like too volatile and people just hate it and I get booted out of Hollywood, I can go back to like painting paintings or something.
Right.
But to have a bunch of like low budget, very interesting, super edgy films, and not have something cinematic. My whole goal with this was cinema, like big scale cinema and archetypal storytelling and archetypal, you know, lead character. I would not be happy to be a guy that didn't have that in my body of work. So that's really, you know, that's really the thinking.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you talk a little bit about, you brought up the socioeconomic issues, and one thing in this text I'm looking at is race relations that you see in this film as well. Mm-hmm. And I know you mentioned Tijuana, but can you talk a little bit about how you sort of divided the races? Because I know that I saw one black guy in the L.A. kind of pit or whatever, and then at the
in
end...
In future L.A.?
Yeah, at the end I saw it looked like Africa or something was charging towards...
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
How did you go about deciding how you were going to... what you show?
If I could add something to what she's saying as well, the people up on Elysium seem to speak largely French and English, and I'd like to know how you got to that as well.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, sure.
It's fine.
This is basically the idea, right? There's two things. The one is metaphor and just trying to stick true to metaphor. So when you're talking about metaphor, right now, I specifically didn't want to include China because it just complicates things. But right now, wealth is contained within North America and Europe. So they're going to be speaking English or North America or European languages. And it happened to be French because Jody is fluent in French. So you would presumably have many other languages happening on the station within European languages, to hold true to the metaphor. So that's the metaphor part of it. The other metaphor part actually is wanting to... It's like me being in Tijuana. It's like wanting to flip the point of view for Americans where this is what it feels like to be on the other side of the fence, looking over the fence. You know, in this case, it's looking up at Elysium, but it's kind of flipping America into a dilapidated, broken, more economically depressed America. So I wanted those two things, the languages on the station and the metaphor of America being broken. And then the third thing is painting this realistic image of a future Earth that is my realistic version of a future Earth, which meant the borders being erased entirely and having this fluid population group that basically moves from Chile all the way up to Canada. It just flows because it can. It's kind of like the EU, like much more like the EU on steroids. And so that I just wanted that to feel real, like as real as possible. And the numbers of people that are Latin are going to overwhelm the numbers of people that aren't. And if you, again, hold true to the metaphor, the wealth would have gone to the station. The only thing that didn't stick true to the metaphor or the realism part was that in Mexico City, I couldn't get enough black actors. I tried as hard as I could, and the only black actor that I could find in Mexico City was the kid at the end who's running when you see the three ships landing and he goes and tells his parents that ships are coming. That was literally the only guy that I could find. That's how, it's just insane in Mexico, how few actors there were. So the other shot you were talking about, I shot in Johannesburg when I was shooting a test for the new film that's half the size of Elysium. When I was shooting a test for that, I was trying to do exactly what you just brought up. And I was like, we should roll some footage of people running to the ships while we're here. And that's what that was.
Okay.
I'm curious, on every film, you sort of learn a little bit about the craft. And I've spoken to Fincher before, and he talked about how he doesn't use cranes on set so he can keep the $5,000 per day to use towards a meal penalty or something. Like, he was telling me the way he breaks everything down.
Sure.
I'm curious what you learn... What?
No, I was just thinking about the concept of Fincher being efficient with money, but anyway.
It was just an interesting conversation the way he thinks about things. And I'm just curious what you learned on Elysium with having this much money. You talked earlier about making everything fluid on a set, you know, not dealing with the politics. What did you learn about the big budget filmmaking that you can apply if you ever do have another budget on this level? Things that you might want to, you know, make sure happen.
You know what? To be honest, it was the same as District 9 because it was trying to punch above its weight the same way District 9 was. So production, there was three times as much money, right? But there were four times as many requirements. So it felt as stringent as District 9. There was actually no different approach to the way that we made it. It was like everybody was under the same amount of pressure. I was a little bit more prepared, which helped, you know, like in terms of what shots I wanted and how I wanted to do things. And the actors, like the Jodies and the Matts that are such consummate professionals that they actually sped it up. It was probably quicker than District 9, actually, because they just do exactly what you ask them to. I don't know if that answers the question, though. But
I'm curious more about the behind the scenes, like anything you learned.
I see what you mean.
With unions or with all that kind of stuff.
I thought you meant production.
Well, that too. I mean, I'm just curious about the behind the scenes stuff. Whether it be camera rentals or whether it be certain things that you know what I mean?
No, it's all the same. It's all the same. It really is the same. Like the stuff that the smarter thing for the filmmaker to learn is just the political stuff. It's just how, like on Elysium, I had extreme amounts of control for a director at this budget level that's only done two films. But you can still do better. You know, you can still get it to the point. I want to get as close to like sketching artwork with listening to headphones. I want to get as close to that process, making a film, as I can. And you just have to be smarter and smarter about how you set the films up, and you know what the people that are giving you the money to make the films with are how big the playground is, you know, and how alone you will be left.
You talked about future projects that you have in your head. Do you foresee yourself for the remainder, you know, for the foreseeable future, continuing to do your own projects as opposed to, you know, taking on like someone else's franchise, like a Marvel movie or a Star Wars or something?
I don't see myself taking on. I mean, maybe. You know, the thing. This is my thought process. My thought process is, it's exactly what I was just saying. I just want to be an artist that's just left alone. That's really what I want, right? And I want to make stuff that just. Films are the only art form that require commerce so desperately. Mm. Like, you know, any other artist needs a few dollars for a paintbrush, really, if you think about it. Mm. Like musicians or authors, like they can be as free as they want. This is the one thing that just needs like copious amounts of money. So if you imagine a filmmaker trying to just be left alone as much as possible and make Star Wars, how does that work?
Right.
Exactly. And it kind of doesn't. But
until you make a shitload of money and then can do it yourself.
I mean, don't you
feel like... Now, that's my style. That's what I want to do.
Don't you feel like you're left alone, too? I mean, I imagine...
Not on those... You see, this is the thing. Even if... Let's say the contract says, leave Neil alone, and you'll get sued if you don't, right? Even if you do that, you will still have people. You'll have so much static noise of, like, we know you don't have to do this, but we really think Darth Vader, in this film, he should be green and not black. You know what I mean? So, I don't even want to hear that. Like, I just want to hear nothing. So, this is my thought process. The process is to have other brains that have thought of and come up with this kind of canon and, like, you know, literature that is stacked this high of this mythology that's, like, very cool and super interesting, and I can draw from this thousands of other minds that have thought this stuff up. That's a hyper-appealing thing because it's, like, it's actually, in a way, it's more creative. You can already envision everything. It's been done for you. So that is very tempting. But I know the expense that comes with it, you know, and it's just currently at this point I'm not willing to do that, you know. That's really the thinking. But that doesn't mean that I'm unbelievably, you know, yearning to work with some of those franchises, like even the ones that affected me when I was a kid. You know, it would be so cool to do them.
Did you feel like you had a lot of people in your ear on this one telling you?
Not really. I mean, relatively, no. You know, it was actually. I was lucky, I think. You know, it was set up well.
Is that one of the problems that... I'm sure you're sick of talking about this because it's the best, but is that one of the problems that came up when you were working on the Halo movie?
Well, Halo would have been... That's like... Imagine someone just getting flogged for, like some sort of Singapore, like, corporal punishment thing. Like, that would be me directing Halo. The only thing that made a huge difference to the situation would have been Peter Jackson. Like, PJ could have been some sort of interference shield that may have made some quite radical difference to the way that I would have gone through that particular meat grinder. But, no, that is just literally a different scenario. I mean, I'm just a different filmmaker now. Like, I cannot imagine the shit that would have gone down if that production had actually been made. But Peter may have been able to shield me from it, and you know, possibly. The world of Halo, though, and the mythology of Halo is still something that I find... It's like Star Wars, you know? It's like, it's just... It, again, it's so appealing to me because it's cool and it's there and it's like I can imagine it. But you have to do it in a way that you can do it yourself.
I agree with you. I mean, it's such an amazing mythology and it would have been really cool if you had done it. It seems like some of the ideas, at least... from whatever you may have been thinking for that film, particularly the ring world of Elysium, obviously the, you know, some of the robots, how much of that made it into Elysium, like, as a conscious thing for you?
Consciously, nothing. Subconsciously, it's impossible to know. But yeah, consciously, it wasn't meant to be anything. I mean, even the ring, the one thing about Halo that I always wanted was, like, I always felt that the ring was, like, incomprehensibly too, it was too big. And it didn't have any buildings on it, which drove me insane. It was just nature. The only way that you could see something cool was you had to get into the substructure of it. And that always used to irk me when I was working on the film. I was like, it's too... It's just nature. It's like a bunch of dudes in nature the whole time. So, you know, yeah. Maybe there's a subconscious thing with, like, fleshing out a ring that actually has, you know, suburbia on it. But no, consciously, not much. We also didn't... The version that we were making was a little bit... It hadn't gone far enough down the road that I could pull ideas like that with. More what I had done was were things like fleshing out what all of the different creatures look like and the planets and the tone and the vibe of it. You know what I mean? More than conceptual ideas. Yeah. I hadn't really gone there yet.
I see that you are wearing Mandela's prison number.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell how his influence has impacted the way that you view some of these issues that helped create the story?
Well, you know, again, that's subconscious, I think. I can't point to a conscious, rational thing. I mean, I think the way that he dealt with not turning the country on itself and, you know, the sort of level of... moral high ground that he took is incredible. I mean, I think that is inspiring, but all of those things are linked. You know, Tijuana is as linked as that thought. They're just you can't pull them apart and see which one actually made it into the film and which didn't. It's too much of a stew.
Do you feel like we're regressing though? Because this seems to be getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I've been to South Africa too. It was pretty except when I was there around 2004. So I mean, is it going further apart, the haves and have nots?
In that particular country?
In general. Is that this your vision for where we're going?
Well, I think this is what I think. I think the genetic structure of human beings has been the same since we were on the African savannah. We're exactly the same species, and we spent several million years evolving into Homo sapiens using particular genetic ways of doing things that were very helpful to us that are no longer helpful to us. And out of a timeline that long, that's where Mesopotamia was, and that's where we are today. So this is now not necessary in the civilizations that we live in. So I think we're not regressing, and we're also not going forward. We're doing exactly what we've always done. The difference is, for the first time ever, and why I think we're going to maybe go off the edge of the cliff, is because now all of a sudden the population growth is exponential. It's never been witnessed before, and we're at like this cutoff point where we're going to either go off the edge, and it's a Malthusian catastrophe, or right before we go off the edge, we'll come up with technology that will get us out of the shit. But other than the curve of population, we would just keep doing the same thing. It would just be like feudal Europe and, you know, Egypt all over again.
Do you have a philanthropic connection to the film at all, or do you sort of have philanthropic connections? Like, are there causes to which you give money or support around some of these ideas?
Yeah, but I mean, it's all, you know, I can't say what, otherwise it isn't really proper philanthropy.
Okay, but I mean...
yeah. It's kind of a catch-22. No, I mean, I do...
Why can't you say?
I just prefer not to, you know, just keep it quiet. But it's basically...
Because it seems like you're really interested in social issues.
Yeah.
It makes sense to...
Yeah. Well, it's also just, I don't know, the older I get, the more, you know... The more I would want to be a beneficial member of society in whatever way.
I'm curious your thoughts on Kickstarter and if it's something that you could ever consider using for, say, a radical idea of yours. Or I should say source funding.
Yeah, source funding, yeah. No, I mean, I think the core idea of it is really brilliant, you know, and is an extension of the linked global world that we live in now. And it's also the most democratic version of funding something. It hasn't occurred to me to use it yet because I don't know. Actually, I've done the comedy that may end my career is sort of financed, so I feel like I'm okay. If that got unfinanced, I'd have to go.
That's the second
to go there. Yeah,
yeah. You're making your next project is a sci-fi comedy.
Chappie. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you released a one-liner for this thing, or is it still under wraps?
No, I'm trying to keep it as under wraps as possible. But I don't know if I would describe it as a comedy. It's science fiction. It's totally different to these two films, but it has funny elements to it.
And what's your shooting schedule / release plan?
The release plan is unknowable at the moment, but the schedule is shoot it the rest of this year and do post next year. Most of next year.
And do you have a studio behind this, or this is being done totally indie?
I'm about to have a studio behind it, I think.
Okay.
Soon.
So basically you're working out the contracts, whatever.
Yeah.
I understand.
But it will get made. I mean, I right after Elysium comes out, I'm going to Joburg to start making the film. So it's happening. I love it. I absolutely love that film. Like, seriously. I love it. I'm so excited about it. It's insane.
And that's not the comedy that's...
No, I'm even more excited about that one, though.
Are you in the casting process? Are you starting to get that together?
For Chappie?
Yeah.
I'm almost done, actually. There's one more role. There's one more role which was offered to someone that is very unusual who just turned me down, which I'm upset about. Mm-hmm. But I've got to find someone for that role.
Was it Eminem?
No, it wasn't Eminem. Yeah, again, yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I'm definitely curious about technology. Digital camera, the evolution of digital cameras over the last few years has been radical.
Mm-hmm.
What is your camera of choice? And is it going to be digital for you from now on? Or can you see film? Or?
Well, you know, the one piece of technology that interests me a lot are IMAX cameras. I find traditional real IMAX mind-blowing, you know, and projected correctly.
Yes.
So, I don't know whether it takes 5 or 10 years for sensors to get to the point that you're talking about IMAX res. It's coming, though.
You know that Bay is shooting Transformers 4, some of the scenes with this new prototype IMAX 3D digital camera that's way smaller, mm-hmm. that they tested it on Born to Be Wild, the IMAX documentary.
Yeah, but the resolution is nowhere near.
100%.
Nowhere near. So it's like in that, you know, plus I hate 3D. But the organic IMAX camera is mind bending. I mean, it is insane.
The full big rig that Nolan uses.
Yeah. That is an insane piece of technology, and that is something that I find very interesting. The problem is, I trade the cash to do that with by putting Die Antwoord in my films. Do you know what I mean? Like, I need another $50 million just to put the IMAX camera to use. And the concepts are too risky to do that with.
So basically, it's something you'll think about for a future project down the road.
Yeah, it has to be a massive film. It has to be like the Dark Knight kind of stuff, though, to be able to actually use a camera like that. The what it does to production is so extreme. Like, for instance, you can't even run that thing and record sound at the same time. The entire movie has to be looped. You know, there's things like that. You're just making a different kind of film. So in terms of a camera that I would like to use, that is something that digital won't get to catching up to within the very soon few years. It's not going to get there. It will get there within 7, but it's not going to get there right now. I love 35mm and the look of 35, but I don't know. I probably won't shoot on it because my stuff doesn't really need to. But I love the look of it, though.
So what camera?
Last question, please.
Red.
Can I?
I just like red because they're so helpful to us too in production. They're so cool, and the you know, now what is a 6K sensor is like, I don't need any more unless I'm going to go IMAX.
I just want to ask real quick about, you know, Sharpless comes such a long way as an actor, and he was great in District 9, but since District 9, he's got
he's done a lot,
so much, What was it like reteaming with him on Elysium and seeing his growth as a performer?
No, he was the same as District 9. He was exactly the same, because I wasn't using whatever traditional shit he learned from other films, we didn't apply. You know, it was like wheeling the cage to like the edge of the door and then like pulling that the front of the cage open and releasing it into the room. That was Shaw, you know, like a wild animal inside every scene. So it was pure improv, old school District 9 style.
Thank you guys.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.